Good evening, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Gulf Manor Synagogue at School of Jewish Studies here in Cincinnati, Ohio. Welcome. Tonight we continue our study of the third chapter of Malachim Aleph, 1 Kings. And I didn't write down exactly where we left off last week, but I have a general vicinity, general area. That's where I think we did. We certainly finished off with a Midrash, Midrash Koheles. The rabbis were explicating a verse in the book of Koheles, and they were talking about how sad it is for a country which has a little boy in charge of the country, and how wonderful it is for a country when there's a, you know, a grown adult who's intelligent who's in charge of the country. And so the rabbis look at those verses, and traditionally we attribute the book of Koheles, Ecclesiastes, to King Solomon. And so the rabbis say, oh, you know, a little boy in charge of the country, that's got to be Solomon when he says these words, cut the kid up. Oh, my goodness, that's childish. I mean, whoever talks like that? Only a kid would talk like that. Then when the mother, when the true biological mother says, I give up, don't do that. I mean, I don't want my kid to die. I just gave birth to him a week ago. Well, don't kill the kid. Let him live. I want my child to live. Every mother does. Let her raise the kid. And the other mother says, I'm not interested in that. Cut the kid in half and kill him. So it becomes abundantly clear to wise King Solomon that the true biological mother is the one filled with mercy for her child. I mean, nobody wants to see a child, nobody normal wants to see a child dead. That other woman, I can't really figure her out. So the real biological mother was revealed by virtue of her mercy. And so, again, getting back to that Midrash, when Solomon said, cut the kid up, the rabbis liken that to a child speaking. Sounds ridiculous. Sounds childish. But then when that elicits the kind of, you know, human response that we're looking for on the part of a mother, a merciful, you know, mother, then King Solomon is compared to a very wise king. Fortunate and blessed is his country, which has such a ruler such as this, somebody who's wise like that. And so that is the Midrash. We did it last week. There's another publication of that Midrash, which kind of piles on the explication. But, you know, I think we did a fair enough job of it as is. And we're going to continue on. So let's do that. But remember, there's something fascinating that comes out over here. When King Solomon says, let's take a look at Pasuk Chav Zayin, verse 27. We're going to mop up the last few verses, and we're going to continue into chapter 4. It may not be the most exciting of all chapters, chapter 4, but we'll try to do it justice. It's a kind of a payroll and a personnel record as to who served in Solomon's cabinet, but we'll try to make it as exciting as we can. At all events, let's do verse 27. A little review cannot hurt. Vayan HaMelech, the king answered, when he hears both women speak, and he hears them say, oh, for heaven's sakes, don't hurt that kid. Give that kid to somebody else. And the other woman says, no, it's all right. I don't want him. I'm not going to get him. You're not going to get him. Cut the kid in half. Divide him. Vayan HaMelech, so the king, this is verse 27 now. So the king answered, Vayom, and he said, Tenu lach es hayalud hachai. Give her the living child. Vahames lo timituhu. And surely do not kill him. Now, the last one who spoke, woman-wise, mother-wise, was the woman who suffered the loss of a child, the cold-hearted woman, who says, neither to him nor to you, cut him up. Now, it looks as if King Solomon is responding to her, to new law, give to her the living baby. But that would be mistaken. Although it's hard to know exactly who he's giving the kid to. Based upon scripture, it's difficult to ferret that out. But still, we come to the conclusion that he's giving it to the merciful mother. He emo, she is his mother, says Solomon. Take a look at Rashi over there. And this is really the upshot. This is what I'm trying to get at. Says Rashi on the words, he emo, she is his mother. Says Rashi, Bas Kol Hofia, a heavenly voice appeared or rang out. Hofia is to make an appearance. So a Bas Kol appeared. A voice from heaven appeared, Vamra, and the Baskol said, he emo, she, meaning, you know, you got to say, the merciful one, the merciful mother is the true biological mother. The only reason I'm really making a big deal out of this is because everybody knows that very famous piece of Talmud where the rabbis are gathered and discussing and debating the oven of Achnai, and incredibly, one rabbi says it is makabel tuma, it attracts and retains impurity. The other one says no, it's tahor, it's clean and pure. And one rabbi says, well, I think I'm right. The other one says, I don't think you are. So the first one says, but I think so. And if I'm correct, well, then let the trees, sway the other way. So they do that. First rabbi says, not very impressed. Here in the Beis Medrash, we're not really looking at the trees. So the first rabbi says, all right, trees are not impressive. I get it. How about this? How about we go with the river? I'll make the river go the other way. That's going to be good. You'll be impressed with that one. And he asks God, and God says, oh, okay. And the river goes the other direction. Well, that's a pretty good one by any account. And the other rabbis are going, sorry, again, not impressive enough here in the Beis Midrash. Here we hear about scripture and rabbinic tradition and logic and we're just trying to figure out the laws. And what are you looking at the river for? So the first rabbi says, oh, tough crowd. So he says, How about this? How about if I ask that the walls of the Beis Medrash cave in, if I'm correct? And they do it. And they did it. All the walls kind of caved in. So the first rabbi says, yes, walls, stay out of this. Yes, there's nothing to do with you, although they're in the Beis Medrash surrounded and supported by those very walls. But all right. The rabbi says, I'm forbidding the walls to cave in and collapse. Stay where you are. Go back to where you are. So the walls were commanded to go back to the original position that they were in. And the Talmud says, out of respect for both sides, the walls kind of did like a mezuzah approach, neither here nor there. Not like Rashi, not like Tosfos, not straight, not horizontal, not vertical, but kind of diagonal. Same thing over there. Excuse me, the walls kind of did a diagonal, and they showed respect to both rabbis. At this point, I think the first rabbi says, man, how about this? How about if I ask heaven who's right? And heaven rings out, this rabbi is correct. He's the one with the right idea. So Rabbi Shimon Levi, I think, is the one that says, well, listen to Baskol's, and I think you see where I'm going now. Lo bashamayim hi. The Torah is not in heaven. This is iconically famous. It's so famous that I'm tempted to give one of my crazy, knockdown, drag out, Shavuos 4 o'clock in the morning lectures, on the lobster shift, and screaming at people, lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven, and we simply do not listen to Baskols telling us what the law is, because if we did that, we'd be waiting all day long for a Baskol, often, if not most of the time, we'd be waiting around for a Baskol, and second of all, the rabbi didn't, that's the point. I mean, the law was given to Moses, who gave it to the elders, who gave it to the Zakenim, and on to the Nevi'im, you get the idea, on to the Zagdola, men of the great assembly, and the rabbis inherited. And this is how we got to do things. I mean, we have to have a system over here. Can't possibly have a situation where things change because somebody heard a Baskol. Guess what? That's actually Christianity. Oh, somebody hears a Baskol. Oh, you're my beloved son. Oh, somebody has a dream. You can eat anything you want. Another guy's got a Baskol. Oh, why are you persecuting me? I'm going, all well and good if you want to go for that. But that's not my idea of a divine religion, okay? That's my idea of, like, you know, every other minute somebody's coming up with an epiphany, oh, and a revelation, oh, wait a minute, what I heard, oh, I heard yesterday, I had a dream, and I'm allowed to eat whatever I want. Really? Torah says no, and you have a dream, and you say yes? That's your religion? Oh, wait till I tell you what happened to me on the road to Damascus. Like, what happened? Well, I was blind and I heard a voice, and now I've changed my whole life. I mean, call it a vote if that's what moves you. But we can't have a religion on that. You can't possibly have, I mean, a religion of law based upon people's particular, visions, and I heard a dream, and unless your name is Martin Luther King. Okay, if you have that kind of dream, I'm willing to listen. Other kinds of dreams, I'm not willing to listen. So that's the Jewish approach. You can't keep on telling me you're hearing dreams and hearing visions, seeing things, and I have to suddenly change my whole life because you saw something, you heard something. We can't have a religion based like that. And that's Rabbi Shimon Levi's approach, and that's normative Judaism. And Lo b'Shamayim, he really does make a lot of sense. And except for over here, what's going on over here? Over here, Bosco is emanating from heaven saying, this is the proper mother. This is the woman to whom you should give the kid. And I'm going, listen, I respect Bosco because guess what? I think I know who's making him. I think I know who's behind him. And it's not me. Okay? I'm not the one who's letting out a voice from heaven going, yeah, that's, you know, that's the right mother. So on the one hand, Bosco's are impressive to a degree, but on the other hand, can't run things like that. And yet over here, Bosco rang out, according to this, and Rashi concretizes it. I mean, he makes it concrete. He brings it into his Pirush, Ala Tanakh. He says that Bosco appeared, and it said, this is the mother. And at least according to Rashi, and maybe it's out of a Midrash, Rashi is following, I think, this Drush. And according to that, Solomon is saying, okay, I'm following it too. At which point I say to myself, I thought that we got this principle of Lo b'Shamayim he. And what do we do with that? So I'm just going to, I wrote it down already. I want to just make sure that I put it into my sefer. So what of Lo b'Shamayim he? Unless you're going to say, well, you know, but I mean, what do you mean, well, you know? I mean, is that only okay? Denigrating and keeping out Boskos is only applicable in a base measure setting, but in a court of law, in Solomon's court, it is okay to listen to a Bosco, but it's not okay to listen to a Bosco in a rabbinic study hall centuries later, but it's okay in Solomon's court. I don't get that. I mean, I'd like to see some more consistency than that. And this is going to be another one of my questions that I'd like to ask one of my rabbis over here in Cincinnati. I'm going to write that down. I ask questions and often I don't get any answers, but that's okay because it makes me a stronger person. Whatever doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Whatever I can't find an answer to. And even he said that questions are really healthy for the mind. They open up your brain. They force you to think. And they make you try to come to terms with things and seek out solutions. So, okay, we'll try to do that. At all events, Bosco. Now, let's continue on. And as we said earlier, we're going to mop up chapter 3. We've already really done quite a bit of it. I do want to note over here on this shiur that some of you might be tempted to Google Solomon Court Law Review, and you'll come across a 20 or 30 page law review written by a woman, a female law professor, I forgot exactly where, and she analyzes this whole story according to American law. At least I think so. I didn't read the whole thing. Whatever I saw on the very front of it was interesting. Didn't get a chance to go through all 30 pages. Things have come up with Purim and planning and programming, and thank God we're having a big Shabbaton this Shabbos. Might as well put in a plug. An all-female Shabbaton, I mean all-female single Shabbaton will be a part of it. It's through NJOP Shabbat Across America. Reverend Rabbi Saul Gettinger of Congregation B'nai Torah in Indianapolis. He'll be a scholar in residence. His Rebbetzin is coming too. If you want, give me a call or email me at paulplotsker@gmail.com, paulplotsker@gmail.com. There's room for you if you want to join the Shabbaton. Try to hook you up. It'd be very, very nice. It's such a big Shabbos. Parshas Paro, Parshas Chazak, Mevorachim Chodesh Nisan. There's a lot going on. So, by all means, we'll have a beautiful Friday night dinner catered at the Kiddush. Do try and make it to Cincinnati. I know I said, oh yeah, so the article. So if you want, Google that article and read it at your heart's content. Probably not going to be able to cover it here in the class unless it's really amazing. And I bring it up and I look through it and it's really worth discussing. Otherwise, we're going to probably finish up right here, right now, and keep on going through chapter 4 tonight. Verse 28. Chavchas, Vayishmu Kol Yisrael Asamishpat Asher Shofar HaMelech. I think we did this last week. All Israel heard the judgment which the king judged. Vayiru Mepnei HaMelech, they feared the king. Ki Ra'u Ki Chochmas Elokim B'Kirbo La'asos Mishpat, because they saw that the wisdom of God, the wisdom of the Almighty, was in him to do judgment. And there's no way you're going to take on such a wise king. He's got the spirit of God in him, and that's all you need to put the fear of God in people. They realize somebody that wise is going to outfox him every time, and he's going to tease out the truth. Don't even bother trying to outsmart him, and you have to respect a smart man like that. So Solomon's prayer to have wisdom has paid off in spades for him, and God bless him for doing that. All right, here we go. Let us continue on. Yeah, they saw that he had such wisdom deep in his heart, he was able to do judgment. It's a wonderful thing. And that's the end of chapter 3. So let us now begin chapter 4. All right. Here we go. Chapter 4, Perek Daled, chapter 4, verse 1. Vayhi HaMelech Shlomo, Melech al Kol Yisrael. King Solomon was the king over all Israel. So what do we have on that? Well, there is something to be said about that. Take a look at Rashi on the very first pasuk. Always got to ask yourself, what's troubling Rashi? That is, of course, the key question. Well, when you study any commentator, what's troubling him? Why does he feel the need to pick up pen and write on paper? What's troubling him? What question is he answering? That's always the query you've got to ask yourself. So over here, what's troubling Rashi are the words that he's playing on. Look at Rashi. Melech al kol Yisrael, king over all Israel. Okay? What exactly does that mean? Over all Israel. That's the word. That to me, the word call, all, is the word that's really being looked at under a microscope, under the rabbinic microscope. You'll see why. It's because his father, David, did not have that kind of luxury. When David took over, he didn't have all Israel loving him, like Solomon seems to have. David had a different situation. Let's read Rashi, and then we're going to see the Radak, either inside or outside. It says Rashi, Mishiro b'chokhmaso, when they saw his wisdom, samchu kulam b'malchuso, all of them were delighted with his kingship. When they all saw how wise Solomon was, they all said, man, now this is a king. Now that is the kind of guy I want as king of Israel. I want somebody who is super wise, super smart, somebody who can take care of things, who can run the show, who's competent, capable, dedicated, smart, and able to get things done and figure things out and lead. You need that. You need that everywhere you are, in every company, in every house of worship, in every family. You've got the demand of high intelligence. Otherwise, things can begin to break down. Somebody who's intelligent and educated says, wait a second, we're going on the wrong path. We've got to stop. Let's get back on track. And that's the mark of intelligence. See, nobody's perfect, and we all make mistakes. But if you see that you're drifting, you say, wait a second, I need to get back on the straight and narrow. Well, when all of Israel saw how wise Solomon was, they were overjoyed. They said, we got somebody at the helm, excuse me, who can really run the show. He's really that smart. And that makes all the difference in the world. Take a look at the Radak in the original Hebrew. And then, if we need it, we'll take a look at the footnote in English. Here's the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi. Again, also over the words Al Kol Yisrael, over all Israel. Lefisha David Aviv lo malach betchilas malchuso Al Kol Yisrael. Because David, his father, did not rule at the very beginning of his kingship over all Israel. He didn't. Do you remember, I'm sure you do, for the first 7 years of David's kingship, he was effectively only ruling over Judah. Maybe there were individuals in the other tribes who were grooving to him, but for the most part, the general consensus among the tribes was, who is this guy? He's from Judah. That's very nice. We respect that, but that's not our king. Maybe they're still smarting from the fact that King Saul had been from Benjamin, and he was, you know, it was deposed. I mean, it was unpleasant, and, you know, he was killed in battle. I mean, a very sad story. Don't get me wrong. He was a man who was head and shoulders above all Israel in so many respects, and then he took ill. It was not a pleasant last few years of his life. So it could be that some of the B'nai Israel back then said, you know something, it just feels like we're cheated. And now we got to take on this guy. Who is this guy anyway? Just from Judah? Eh. So they just kind of, you know, either they ignored him or they just kind of sidestepped him, and they didn't feel that he was their king. But Solomon, and then of course David was, ultimately after 7 years, and for the last 33 years of his life, for a total of 40 years of kingship, 33 years he ruled over all Israel, first 7 years only over Judah, 33 over the rest of the entire nation of Israel. So that was the sad story for David. But Shlomo, he inherited the kingdom, and then he kept it going, and the whole of Israel said, wow, this guy is a superstar. He is a supernova of wisdom. We got to follow a guy like that. And so they did. So David did not have the same kind of great opening act, if you will, that his son had. Amar Shlomo Molach al Kol Yisrael. Scripture says that Shlomo reigned over all Israel. V'lo haya adam mefak peh b'malchuso. And nobody was like quibbling and questioning and doubting and second-guessing and on his kingdom, his rulership. Kevan shira'u bo chokhmas Elokim b'kir bo. Because they saw that there was the wisdom of God inside him. Lasos mishpat. He had, and that's the whole pasuk. We've got to read the whole thing together. Kevan shira'u bo chokhmas Elokim b'kir bo. Lasos mishpat. The Deradak is quoting the last few words of the pasuk. They saw what a wise man he was. He had God's spirit in him, God's wisdom in him, and therefore they were more than happy to have him as king. Good. Take a look at that English footnote. I try to do them all so we know that we cover that. Solomon was more fortunate than his father David, who for the first 7 years was king over the tribe of Judah alone. For, quote, when they saw his wisdom, they all rejoiced in his kingdom. End of that, words of Rashi. And none dared oppose him. Nobody opposed him. Great. Pasuk Beis. The Eila has now, people, I don't know how to say this. I like to think that I can make the New York telephone pages, the white pages, sing and be exciting and read every single name and make a joke and make it exciting. I like to think I could do that. Over here, we're going to be listing off a lot of names. This one did this, that one did that. This was his position, and that was his position. I'm hoping that you'll stay with me. It's sacred scripture, even if it may not be the David and Bathsheba saga, or you know the rebellions of Adonijo and Avshalom. Those are really exciting narratives. We're not going to have that kind of level of excitement here by any stretch, but please stay with me because every single word is sacred and holy, and we're learning Torah. We're getting a mitzvah. We're doing the greatest thing possible, learning Torah. So here we go. Pasuk Beis Ve'Ela Hasar Masher Lo. And these were the princes. These were the dukes. These were the masters. These were the leaders. These were the princes which he had who answered to Solomon. Azariyahu, bank that name. We might see that name again. We will in verse 5. Seems to be a popular name back then. Azariyahu ben Tzadok HaKohen. So Azariyahu, the son of Tzadok, the Kohen. And he was a prince. He was one of the Sarim. Okay? Take a look at, let me read you a footnote. Azariyahu, the son of Tzadok. He was really the son of Achimaatz, the son of Tzadok. Now, Scripture makes it sound as if he's the son of Tzadok. In actuality, he's really the grandson of Tzadok. You, so if that's the case, mention the father. But according to the commentators, grandchildren are considered children, as Rashi says in the verse in Genesis chapter 20, verse 12. Grandchildren are considered children. See Rashi over there on that pasuk. Although his position to which he was appointed is not mentioned in this sentence, it refers to the next pasuk. Okay, all we're told is that he was one of the Sarim. He was one of the princes. And he's a Kohen. So knew what kind of a Kohen. Was he the Kohen Gadol? So what did he do? What was he? We don't really know if all we see is verse 2. Say the Mepharshim, he may not have his position explicitly mentioned in verse 2, but it refers to the next sentence. We're going to get there in a moment. Azariyahu, Elichoref, and Achia were appointed scribes. So says the Abarbanel, so says the Radak. And so we're going to kind of like read it as a run-on sentence. The next pasuk, Gimel, will give us the next names. And they're all going to be hired and serve the king as sofers. Let's go see that. Let's see verse 3. Elichoref, v'achiyo b'nei Shisha sofer. Elichoref and Achia, who were the sons of Shisha, were scribes. They're the ones who wrote down the records. We'll see a little more about that in a second. And presumably, Azariyahu ben Tzadok is also one of the scribes. And we continue and finish off the Pasuk Gimel, Yehoshaphat ben Achilud HaMazkir. Yehoshaphat was the Mazkir. Well, technically, in modern Israeli Hebrew, the secretary. They call him the recorder. In other words, the keeper of the books, right? I mean, the one who maintains records. Dare I say, the clerk of the court. Maybe that's a way to call it. Amazing that we have that verb and that title, as far as I know, and it's used in modern Israeli Hebrew. Hamazkir, the secretary, the one who keeps the records. Let's go take a look and see what there is to see among the commentators. See Rashi, Sofrim, they are scribes, Lichtov, Divrei HaYamim. They were the ones who would write the chronicles. They wrote the records of the kingdom. Okay? Question Do they have any impact on the writing of the book of Malachim? I think not, according to the rabbis, but I would presume that they were writing down on a day-to-day basis who did what, who was doing what, perhaps even the court cases. We're going to see that in a moment. Let's go right to it. You know, Shepherd was the maskir. He was the secretary. He was the recorder. So what's the maskir? He was the one, and of course, that I'll just give you a little grammar. The verbalist core means to remember, binyan pal or kal verb, plain and simple verb. In the hifiel, in the causative paradigm or binyan, to make somebody remember is to remind him. So Aniya, you know, the butler, the wine butler says, oh, it's a fair. He says, oh my goodness, eschatai ani maskir hayom. I believe that's the verb that's used over there. I mention here today my sins. You could say it's the verb lahaskir means to mention, to cause, to remember. And so that's the position of this individual. He's making people remember what happened in the past. Says Rashi the Maskir, Eze Mishpa Balafon of Rishon, Shif Sekenu Rishon. You know, which judgment, which case on the docket has come before him first, and which has come second. So he has to know, the king's got to know what the order of the case is, what's the order. So he'll know who to judge. This party goes first, that party, that court case goes second, that one goes third. Kach shamati. So says Rashi, that's what I've heard. Interesting that he would write that. All right, so again, scribes, the function of scribes among the king's officers was to write the chronicles of the king, says Rashi. Others maintain each of the three scribes had specific duties. One was to record the laws and judgments. Another was to keep an accounting of the king's finances and taxes. And the third was to write the chronicles and royal documents. So says the Abarbanel. Everybody had his own job to do. The recorder, the maskir, Yar Shafak, what was his job? His duty was to remind the king, says Rashi, which judgment came before him first, that he might decide it first. That's what I've heard. Others suggested, you know, this is a fascinating comment. Others suggest the duties of this office were similar to those of an attorney general and secretary of the treasury in the United States. So says the Abarbanel. Really? The Abarbanel wrote that? The Abarbanel wrote that in the, late 1400s and early 1500s? Pretty amazing. That this is similar to the attorney general and the secretary of the treasurer in the United States. He was quite a visionary person, the Abarbanel was. Anyway, so that's the duties of the maskir, potentially the one who, the clerk of the court, or the chief prosecutor and the chief of the treasury of the United of the kingdom of Solomon. All right, very good. Pasuk Dalet. Ubnayahu ben Yehoyada al Hatzava. Ubnayahu, the son of Yehoyada, was the chief general. He was over the host, meaning he was over the armed forces. The Tzadok, Eviasar, Kohanim. And Tzadok and Eviasar were the Kohanim. They served in, at least initially, in the Mishkan. And soon, Solomon is going to build a magnificent edifice for the Almighty. And they would hopefully then serve there in the temple. Let's go ahead and take a look at the footnote. And Tzadok and Eviatar were the priests, although Shlomo had banished Eviatar from being the Kohen Tashem. Take a look at chapter 2, verse 27 above, where he effectively really did. He kicked out Eviatar, new, so why are you mentioning him over here? If he's no longer functioning as a priest, as a Kohen, he's no longer functioning. It's not a crime, just don't mention him. So the answer possibly is, even though he's been banished, Says the Radakis was probably another man with the same name. Another Evyatar. Says the Rabag, it's also possible that he was occasionally recalled to serve when Tzedek was unfit. Maybe when Tzedek was tamei or ill. But probably, usually when he is in a state of tumah, then you want somebody else who's got the knowledge and the experience. And according to the Ralbag, Solomon would turn to Evyatar. Even though he had sent them out a chapter ago, still in all, with his knowledge base and his experience, he came in handy when Tzedek was unavailable. All right. We are just swimming along over here, aren't we? Might even be able to knock off the whole chapter. Wow. First, Pasuk Hey. Verse 5, Va'azayahu, there's that name again from the first Pasuk, Va'azayahu ben Nasan ala nitzavim. And Azayahu, the son of Nasan, was over the officers. I kind of thought that that was Benayahu's job. I'm not sure exactly what to make of that. When I hear that Benayahu was over the Tzava, he was over the whole host, meaning the whole army, I would have thought that that also includes all the officers of the army. And I'm wrong. And I am wrong to think that because we've got to see Rashi on the Pasuk, and Rashi's going to perhaps also be troubled by that. He's going to give an answer. Let's read the Pasuk. Azariah, the son of Nasan, was over the officers. Hold that question. Who are the officers? The Zavud ben Nasan, Kohen, Rea HaMelech. And Zavud, the son of Nasan, was Kohen. He was a Kohen. He was a principal officer. Rea HaMelech, friend of the king. The king's friend. What does that mean? Let's go take a look and see if anybody is weighing in on that. Yes, the Matzudas Dabba does. First Rashi, what does it mean, Al Hanitzavim? Azariah ben Nasan in verse 5 is called Azariah, the son of Nasan. What's his job? He's over the officers. What does that mean? Says Rashi, Shnemasar Nitzivim Haryulo. He had 12 standing men, 12 officers, to provide food for the king and his household. And that was their job. So no, not like I thought earlier that, oh my goodness, these guys are, you know, lieutenants and captains and whatnot. And if that's true, then they're also part of the army. And if that's true, then why aren't they simply being led by Benayahu, Ben-Yoyada? Answer is, these guys have a whole different job. These guys are making sure that if there's food available for the king and his household. We're going to see why. Because the king had enormous numbers of people joining him for meals. If you think that some of the Bali Chesed in Yerushalayim and Bnei Barak are big, and they are, I'm not saying they're not. When you have 50 people on a Lo Shabbos, it's a bunch of people. And we thank God here at Gulf Atlantic Synagogue, we had close to 60 men, women, and children at our Purim Seuda. It was truly a Nachas Ruach. And Baruch Hashem, we had an anonymous donor who made it happen so people could enjoy a Seuda that's a mitzvah and have no money taken out of their pocket and have a beautiful ambiance, lit lights, dim lights, and candles on the table, beautiful catered meal for free, and my brother played piano, and the rabbi spoke, and even I got in a couple of words edgewise. And you know something? It was a beautiful hour and a half. It really was. Now, we had 60 people, and we thought that was a very nice crowd. And thank God this coming Shabbos night, we're having right now close to another group of 60 people. Hopefully we'll go over that number. And Baruch Hashem, we're happy with these numbers. Wait till I tell you how many people King Solomon was feeding on a regular basis. I know you're not going to believe it. But we're going to hopefully get to it tonight. And I want to, it's hard to believe. God willing, we'll get to it tonight. Okay? So, King Solomon has 12 officers, and these men are obligated to supply the king with his food, and food not only for himself personally, but also his household. Okay? And what does it mean to say that you're a Re'a HaMelech, a friend of the king? What's that mean? Says the Mitzvah David, Yashavimo B'tmidut. He sat with him consistently, in a consistent manner. Okay? In order to be able to serve him. So that is what's going on over here. He had a wonderful a group of men, and they all were loyal to him, and they all served him. Take a look at verse 5. Verse 6, rather, I'm sorry. Verse 6. V'achishor al habayis. Achishor was over the household. V'adoniram ben Avda al Hamas. And Adoniram, son of Avda, he was in charge of the levy. Mas, of course, means tax in modern Israeli Hebrew. And that's really what it means even in ancient Hebrew, it seems. A levy is a tax. So the question is, Adoniram, what did he do? I mean, Achishar, he was over the household, I get it. What was Adoniram's job as the man on the tax, or the man over the tax? Let's take a look at Rashi in the English translation. He was overseer of the taxes of forced labor which Shlomo had raised on the Israelites. As it is said, King Solomon raised a levy. He raised a specific tax. We're going to see that soon in chapter 5, verse 27. So hold that thought. Bank that thought. Already, though, we're being introduced to the name of this individual and his job. He was the tax man, as the Beatles would say. And I'm going to make a bracha. I am getting thirsty. Wow, people. Is there anything better than ice cold water when you're thirsty? Nothing. Okay. So he was in charge of the taxes of forced labor, which Solomon raised on the Israelites. Got to wait. I haven't really gotten there yet, so I want to hold off and try to understand what that means. Forced labor, and he's raising taxes and so on. Let's let the scripture flesh it out for us in due time. And all events, like I said, keep that name and his task in your mind. Verse 7, Pasuk Zayin, V'lish Shlomo, Shneim Asar Nitzavim, Al Kol Yisrael. Solomon had 12 Nitzavim, people who stand, meaning, you know, not, of course they stand in front of the king, but they're doing stuff too. What's their job? They are officers dedicated to doing his will. He had 12 officers, Al Kol Yisrael, and they served over all Israel. Excuse me, it just sounds like each one per shevet. The Chilkelu es HaMelech v'Esbeso. And each man provided food, nourishment, and food items, foodstuffs for the king and his household. Chodesh Bashana Yiyeh Al Ha'echad L'Chakel. The word is Ha'echad, put the hay in there. Okay? Each man per month had to make provision in a year. Again, Chodesh Bashana, eat 1 month in the year, Yehiyeh Al Ha'echad L'Chalkel, would fall upon one person, L'Chalkel, to nourish, to keep afloat, to feed. Okay? Each man had to make a provision for a month in the year. But what does that mean? Each man, what did he do? Once a month he fed, what did he do? Did he feed the whole the throne? I mean, the court, the Solomonic court? To defeat somebody else? What was he doing? What's that all about? So let's go ahead and take a look at, and it's an exceptionally long footnote for verse 7. So we'll do it in English. We're slowly getting there. So let's go ahead and do verse 7 in English. The footnote. 12 officers over all Israel. Shlomo applied great wisdom in arranging the provision of victuals, love that word, foodstuffs. Shlomo applied great wisdom in arranging the provision of food in order not to overburden the people and affect the general economy adversely. He divided the country into 12 regions. Isn't that something? I would have thought that they already are in 12 regions just by virtue of their 12 tribes, but I may be wrong for all I know. At all events, this is what it says. He divided the country into 12 regions. I'm going to underline that and ask myself if that was reflective of the 12 tribes too. Okay, we'll just make that note. There you go. Good. It was the responsibility of each area. He's got 12 areas all divvied up. It was the responsibility of each area to supply the necessary food for 1 month of each year. Yeah, 1 month is not so bad, and we're all in this together, and it does make some sense. It was, again, the responsibility of each area to supply the necessary food for 1 month of each year. Okay? Each area chipped in food enough for 1 month of the year. It was the duty of the officer in each region who was most familiar with his territory and its general finances to collect the food in such a manner and in sufficient amounts during the year so as to fill the requirements for his month. So every individual had a duty to raise the amount, to raise the finances, to collect the food in such a manner and in such amounts so as to fulfill the requirement for that month. That area had 1 month, the second area had another month, third area another month, and 12 areas, 12 months, and that's how you do it. That's how you get by, each area supporting for 1 month seemingly everybody else. Okay? So for 11 months you're able to slide, and 1 month you have got to perform big time. And that's the Ralbag and the Malbim saying that. Okay? Now we continue, and it's going to be quoting the Abarbanel. The commentaries vary as to the exact function of these officers. Abarbanel quotes the opinion of some that declare these officers were instructed to gather and collect the funds with which the victuals for the king were bought. He would collect, he would shaf gelt, then he would go to ancient Costco, put down his money, and buy food for the Solomonic court. Okay? They are instructed to gather and collect the funds with which the food for the king was brought. Bought. Abarbanel himself, rejecting this opinion, insists that their duty was only to buy the necessary food. The funds for this purpose were supplied by the king. How and where the king got the money is not mentioned. Their main purpose was to buy the food at such times of the year which would least affect the prevailing prices in the market. The problems involved were many. Now get this. According to Abarbanel, there were 60,000 guests at the king's table daily. 60,000 people. I cannot imagine what that must look like. Descending upon, I just don't understand. I mean, that is Shea Stadium, or I guess I'm dating myself. That's Yankee Stadium. That's Citi Field. It's a good-looking baseball field filled up with 60,000 people. Now, that is extraordinary. These people included visiting monarchs and diplomats, as well as those who came up to observe the king's unbelievable wisdom. At times, the king would be living outside of his palace. to various parts of the country, either on vacation or otherwise. Again, at times the king would be living outside of his palace in various parts of the country, either on vacation or otherwise. This abundant and plenteous supply of food was to be supplied at the correct time and place in sufficient amounts. Above all, this included the rare and oftentimes thick, costly fruits and vegetables and other delicacies which were out of season, as befit the gourmet taste of royalty and its guests. So you've got rare and at times costly fruits and vegetables, which for your average Joe are out of season and therefore out of that price range. But if you want to pay top dollar, you can get whatever you want in this world. So they did that. They listened to the Abarbanel, and that's what they did. And the Abarbanel, again, says that King Solomon had a table fit for a king. He had food there that would have been out of season in Israel, and he imported it. Okay? And so these men would provide, they would provide the food, the chilkulos and melachas beso. They included the food for the king. Rashi seems to be in accordance with both opinions mentioned previously. The duties of the officers included the provision of all his meals, which includes those of his guests. And the words in the scripture, the food of the numerous horses, end quote, in his possession, end quote, and all the needs of his expenditure. So there was a lot of money being laid out over here, both in raw goods and also the cooking and the cleaning. I mean, that's all I think about sometimes as the chairman, the director of programming, who's cleaning up, who's setting up, who's breaking down, who's catering it, who's going to serve it. It's like a nonstop worry zone in my head. Oh my goodness, do I ever need Pesach to come along and free me from the bondage? Let me tell you. But in all events, the king had a plenteous supply of rare food that was gained by, well, frankly, paying for it, paying top dollar for it, and bringing it into your King Solomon's royal palace. Okay? So that's what they did. They provided... Oh, let me just finish off. Let me just make sure I get it all in. Who provided victuals for the king. Okay? The Chilkulos HaMelech, Vez Beso. Rashi seems to be in accordance with both opinions mentioned previously. The duties of the officers included the provision of all his meals, which includes those of his guests, 60,000 strong. Okay? Quote, and the food of the numerous horses, end quote, in his possession, and, quote, all the needs of his expenditures, end quote. So he had a lot of expenditures. This final obligation seems to indicate that tax collection, too, was part of their duties. The king was thus provided with a source of income to cover this enormous budget. And an enormous budget it had to be, truly, to be able to feed 60,000 people, it says here, daily. I mean, that's like three times bigger than a Sattler wedding, and that's pretty big itself. So we continue on. Pasuk Ches Ve'ela Shemosam, and these were their names. These are the names of those who are the Nitzavim. These are the ones who are the individuals, the officers, who were in charge of the food. Okay? The Elish Mosam, these are their names. Ben-Hur, Bahar Ephraim. That's all he's known as. Ben-Hur. Did they make a movie out of this guy? No, they made a movie out of a first century guy named Ben-Hur. Not this guy named Ben-Hur. Sorry, people. Okay? This Ben-Hur was living at Mount Ephraim. Pasuk, let me just make sure. Let's take a look at Pasuk Ches. The footnote, the son of Hur in Mount Ephraim. Those officers who were well known by their own name were identified thereby. Those, however, who were comparatively unknown by their own name, but rather by their father's name, were identified by their father's name. Okay, that's fascinating and good to know. All right, let's keep going. We are just tearing it up, as some of the guys over here in the call will say. Tes ben Decker b'markatz u'v'shalvim u'v'et shamesh. See that? They had shalvim even then. But back then, it was a town, not a yeshiva. At least that's what we know. The son of Decker, this is verse 9. Ben Decker, the son of Decker, in Makaz, or Makatz, and in Shalvim, Uvei Shemesh. Okay, in Bet Shemesh, they loaned Beit Hanan. There as well. The sons of Decker were in Machaz, I'm sorry, Makatz, Shalvim, Beit Shemesh, and a loan from the house of Hanan. Okay, take a look. Let's go on to verse 10. Ben Chesed Bo'arubot, the son of Chesed in Aruvot, lo, according to him, Socho was Sukkah. I'm sorry, was Socho. B'chol Eretz Chefer. Again, verse 10, Ben Chesed Ba'arubos, Lo Socho B'chol Eretz Chefer. The son of Chesed and Arubos, to him pertained Socho B'chol Eretz Chefer and all the land of Chefer. And doesn't the word Socho come up in our Mishnayos? Socho. Sure sounds familiar. Okay, not much in verse 10. And so we continue into verse 11. Ben Aminadav, the son of Avinadav, Kol Nafas Dor, all the region of Dor. Tafas Bashlomo. Okay, Tafas Bashlomo. Tafas, the daughter of Solomon. Haisa lo l'isha was to him a wife. This is not an easy verse to explicate. Tafas, the daughter of Shlomo, oh, I see. Tafas Bashlomo was married to Avinadav. Okay, let's take a look at the footnote on verse 11. The region of Dor, boy, you know, let me tell you. The region of Dor. The word Nafas, and that appears up there in verse 11, Ben Aminadab, call Nafas Dor, the son of Aminadab, all the region of Dor. The word Nafas is not part of the name. Don't think that the name of the place is, Avinadav. Okay? The word Nafas is not part of the name. It means the region or district of Dor. We find a similar usage of this word in Joshua 17, verse 11. Fascinating. Okay, so this is Rashi. Okay? The region of Dor. And Tafas, daughter of Shlomo, was married to this individual this person. Okay? Tafas, the daughter of Shlomo, was to him as a wife. She was married to Avinadav. In verse 15, we find another officer who wedded a daughter of Solomon. They did not, however, marry Shlomo's daughters at the time of their appointment, but much later, since Shlomo had no daughter of marriageable age at this time. Right. There was no way they could have married any daughter of Solomon. According to most Mefarshim, Solomon himself was a little kid. I mean, what was he, 8 years old, 11 years old when he took over? Well, name the year, but he did not have a daughter of his own. So these individual men had to wait until Solomon had children and raised them until they were of marriageable age. Okay? Although you would think, based upon your reading of the verse, oh, his name is Rabinadab, he's an officer. Tapas, the daughter of Shlomo, lists him as a wife. As soon as he became an officer, he got married to Bat Shlomo. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. These men were appointed early on in Shlomo's career, and he himself was exceptionally young, and therefore he had no daughters to give to these individuals. Okay? We're wrapping it up. Another minute, and we'll do one last. Pasuk 12. Ba'ana ben Achilud ta'anach u'megida. Okay, Achilud, I thought I saw that name earlier. Alright. If I didn't, Ba'ana, the son of Achilud, to him was ta'anach and Megiddo. B'chol Beit Shan, Asher Eitzel Tzarsana, and all Beit Shan, which is beside or next to Tzarsana, mitachas liYisrael, beneath Yisrael, mi Beit Shan ad Avil Mechola, from Beit Shan to Avil Mechola. Ad meiver liyokmaam. The son of Gerar, Let me see. We're finishing up verse 12. Okay. Ba'ana, the son of Achilud, who is in charge of Ta'anach and Megiddo, and all Beit Shan, which is beside Tzarsana, beneath Yisrael, mi Beit Shan ad Avil Mechola, which range from Beit Shan until Avil Mechola, ad meiver liyokmaam, as far as beyond Yokmaam. Take a look at the one last thing, that footnote on 12, to Avil Mechola, as far beyond Yokmaam. Says Mitzvah David, Avil Mechola was the limit of his territory on one side and beyond Yokmaam on the other side. Okay. I want to thank everybody for coming out. Big yashar koach to all of you for hanging with me tonight. I want to wish everybody a wonderful rest of the week. Have a very, very productive last few days of the week. On Shabbos, may you have the most uplifting of Shabbosos, B'vachim Chodesh Nisan, reading Parshas Para, ending off the book of Shmos with Vayakel Pekudei, and saying Chazak. We wish that you have a wonderfully big and uplifting Shabbos. Join us in Cincinnati at Gulf Manor Synagogue if you can. If you can't, no worries. You'll get us another time. Wishing everybody a great rest of the week and a very, very good Shabbos. For those of you who are also in my Eimah Banim Smecha class on Sunday nights, please remember, as I mentioned the other night, Sunday night, I said to everybody that I cannot make it this coming Sunday, because I'm going to be at a Chappelle's dinner in Teaneck, God willing. They're flying over a lot of the faculty. Haven't seen them in a dog's age. I really have to see everybody. It's been so long. So I'm not going to be available to give the shiur in their closet like I did at a Kol function not long ago. That was actually a lot of fun. Over here, I'm flying in, spending good money, meeting people that I haven't seen in years, and who knows when the next time is. We should all live and be well. So I really want to make every second count, and so please understand, therefore, this coming Sunday, no Eimah Banim Smecha class will resume a week from the Sunday, but God willing, next week we'll continue on with Shlomo and his cabinet, and we'll continue studying chapter 4. Wishing everybody a great rest of the week and a great Shabbos. Shmuel Pastor signing off from Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Have a great week and a great Shabbos. Take care. Bye-bye.